thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, a biweekly discussion of how digital media and technology are affecting learning, teaching, and scholarship at colleges, universities, libraries, and museums.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.
This is Digital Campus number 16 for the 4th of December, 2007. Steal this book. I'm Dan Cohen. We're back from our Thanksgiving hiatus. Hope all of our listeners had a good Thanksgiving. And, of course, we're back with the regulars, Tom Scheinfeld from foundhistory.org. Hi, Tom.
Hey, Dan.
And Mills Kelly from edwired.org. Hey, Mills.
Hey, how are you?
Good. Both of you had a good Thanksgiving?
Yeah, really nice.
Yeah, mine was excellent.
Ah, great. Well, we came back to the same firestorm that we had going into Thanksgiving, and which we talked about on our last episode, Digital Campus episode 15, where Facebook continues to, to put it charitably, push the edge of or the boundaries of propriety and privacy. In particular, really this past week has been a real flare-up over Facebook Beacon. Well, we're all on Facebook. Have any of you seen these Beacon advertisements? So just for people in our audience who are not heavy Facebook users or who haven't been following this story, part of their new advertising platform is it allows commercial partners like Overstock.com or Fandango for movie tickets to place a little news link into your Facebook news feed saying, you know, I bought a ticket to go see Pirates of the Caribbean or something like that, or I bought gloves for my daughter, something like that, into your news feed, and it inserts you. And like all things Facebook, and I think this initially happened with the news feed as well, there was a flare-up when the news feed itself started where Facebook just goes and does this, and then I guess waits around to see how much people care about the invasion of their privacy, and then scales it back to the level that that matches up. But I haven't actually gotten one of these advertisements or whatever they're called, recommendations, into your newsfeed. Have either of you seen one of these yet?
I haven't seen one yet, I have to say, I'm pretty amazed by this, because this is kind of commercial stalking in a way, and kind of taken to the next level. I mean, for years, websites have been tracking with cookies your click-through behavior, and so, there's been a lot of data mining of that, but it's really different to take that information and then, without your permission, display it to potentially to the world. And for me, it raises really serious questions about how many more hours I'm going to have a Facebook account.
Yeah, I was wondering the same thing.
I've gotten these in the past. I've gotten these recommendations where it said, you might like to buy something in my feed, or on my, maybe not in my feed, somewhere on my page. Not an ad. It was, I guess, in the feed. Basically an advertisement, which didn't bother me too much. I mean, every website I go to asks me to buy something, and that's, expected. This seems like something else, where it's advertising to other people what I've already bought. And that seems like a totally different thing. And I agree with Mills. I mean, I'm a pretty heavy Facebook user. I really like it. I'm on there changing my status 3 or 4 times a day, and I think it's fun, and I use it to keep up with friends and stuff. But I'm really, this now scares me, and it's weird, because last time we talked about this, I wasn't scared. I was kind of like nonchalant about it. I was kind of gung-ho. But this finally, I think, put me over the edge. And I think I'm with Mills. I might go cancel my Facebook page.
Well, here's the scary part. So they did back off. I mean, very oddly, MoveOn.org, which is really known as a lefty net roots group, really went after them. And usually they just go after, say, George Bush and Don Rumsfeld. But they took up this cause. I actually do think it made an impact. I mean, it really gave it a kind of national story. I mean, AP picked it up, CNET, the tech news sites picked it up because of MoveOn.org's activity. And of course, there's a Facebook group called Facebook Users Against Facebook Beacon. And that started to take off as well. And so they backed off, actually. We're recording this on Friday, November 30th. It'll probably come out in a few days. But they backed off late last night on the 29th to have it so that it doesn't automatically go into your feed. You have to press a OK button to have it go there. But there's still no opt-out of the program. And if you want to not have purchases, let's say at Fandango, to go on your thing, you have to actually go into your preference, your privacy preferences, and actually opt out of each individual vendor. So you can imagine there'll be hundreds of these vendors. You have to go in and click, I don't want this, you know, the purchases from this place to go on my feed. But even after you've done that, all that's about is what gets shown publicly. It still means that Facebook and the vendors are going to have information about your purchasing habits. And that's a really scary thing, you know, in terms of privacy. So, I mean, there's still value there for both the vendors and for Facebook, that they're kind of getting a lot of profiling on you. And, you know, I still think this is what makes, you know, people are worried about Google, as we said last time, and, you know, what they're able to aggregate. But this is far more pernicious, I think. And I'm also considering canceling my Facebook account.
Yeah, the thing for me that's really the troubling part is, I guess, not so much that information is getting collected, because every time you log onto the computer, lots of information about you is being collected and used in a whole variety of different ways that we don't know about. What is, I think, more troubling about it is that Facebook started posting this information for public dissemination right away without even saying to somebody or saying to the members, here's what we're going to do, what do you think? And you know, it came out initially in the news story as just sort of a funny thing, like Facebook spoiling Christmas surprises by posting people's purchases, and then their boyfriends or girlfriends or husbands or wives saw what they just bought and said, oh, that's what I'm getting for Christmas. Well, you know, it's clearly a lot more than that. There are all sorts of privacy issues here that are really troubling.
Yeah, there sure are. Well, we'll see if what happens on this in the next few weeks. I mean, I think it is interesting that it's in the Christmas season. I mean, there are kind of funny stories, and some of the initial stories emphasize that I guess it was someone found out that they were getting gloves for Christmas from their boyfriend. You wouldn't think this is major, you know, national news, but I think there are going to be more stories like this that people won't realize what's happened, and you know, they'll have one of these beacon flares go up on their newsfeed and be really upset about it. Well, more things to worry about on campus. This will be our worry news segment for the podcast. But quite incredibly, I mean, almost as audaciously as the Facebook beacon is a new House of Representatives bill that seems to be, it was introduced by the top Democrats a couple of weeks ago. And this federal legislation says that universities must agree to provide not just deterrence, but also alternatives to peer-to-peer piracy, such as paying monthly subscription fees to the music industry, paying for Ruckus, which is a sort of advertising-supported music sharing service, or the new Napster, which charges a monthly fee per service. Really unbelievable. Now, of course, the penalty here, and this is what's really putting the pressure on universities, is if they refuse to do this, they can lose all their federal financial aid for their students, for all their students, not just the ones who are pirating the latest Britney Spears song. I'm amazed this hasn't actually gotten more press. I mean, the possible penalties on this seem extraordinarily high.
I mean, it's just outrageous. It's one industry, the entertainment industry, which continues to just break new barriers for outrage. I find this amazing, and especially the fact that they would punish all students and an entire institution for the actions of even just one of its students. It just seems and in such a draconian way. It just is completely outrageous. And again, this is like the Facebook thing. It's kind of like, I feel like I've gotten to the point where this is like, it's like my last straw with all of this stuff. It's really amazing.
Yeah, this one's not going to stand up, because the first time, I mean, members of Congress are going to find out that the first time this actually gets, if it goes through, the first time it actually gets applied, thousands of constituents in their districts where the first college loses all its financial aid, thousands of constituents in their districts are going to flood their offices with hate mail and anger, and they're going to realize, oh, gee, the people who actually vote for me, as opposed to the entertainment industry, are really mad at me personally. And so then they're going to say, how could we have passed this law? It certainly wasn't my idea. and then it'll be, retracted in some way. But it's just like Tom says, it's one industry that's just gone crazy on this.
Yeah, I mean, I can't imagine a more appreciated program than, let's say, Pell Grants. I mean, I don't know.
Right.
I mean, to take away the Pell Grant program, one of the most successful and important higher education bills of in American history, for this kind of a violation. I mean, you'd think you'd have to do something unbelievably outrageous to have that kind of penalty imposed upon you.
And for one industry to target in this way another industry through federal legislation, I mean, and an unrelated industry. I mean, it's the entertainment industry targeting the education industry through federal legislation. I mean, they're not, there are other people who are file sharing from their workplace or wherever. And I mean, for instance, they're not going after. And other industries that receive federal subsidies, they're not going after, for instance, let's say, like the agricultural industry, which receives tons of federal subsidies, and I'm sure who engage in practices, their employees at times, that the record industry would not like. And it's an outrage that it hits, as Mills said, and I think constituents will be outraged. Although, what's amazing to me, as Dan said, is that this hasn't gotten any play. I mean, this isn't at all front page news.
Yeah. Well, when I heard about this, I actually went to the House of Reps, house.gov, and looked up the bill. And when I used their search engine, so I found the committee that passed this legislation. So this is at the initial stage. It hasn't been voted on by the entire House yet. But it's the Committee on Education and Labor in the House of Representatives. And so they have the press release from the chairman of that committee. And, okay, first of all, I mean, this is classic legislator speak. The bill is called the College Opportunity and Affordability Act of 2007. good luck voting against that. And then, so then they have a bullet point list of, sort of a summary, because if you actually read the bill, and they provide a PDF of the bill, and it's, obviously it's very long and I'm not a lawyer and I can't get through it, but they give the bullet points. So here are the bullet points of what the COAA would do. Streamline the federal student financial aid application, make textbook costs more manageable, expand college access for low income and minority students, increase college aid and support programs for veterans and military families, create safer college campuses for students and faculty, ensure equal college opportunities and fair learning environments for students with disabilities, and help strengthen our nation's workforce and economic competitiveness.
Oh, there you go, the competitiveness.
So somewhere in there, I actually think it's under bullet point creating safer college campuses that this P2P
right.
stuff is shoehorned in. But there's nowhere in there does it say anything about this. And, I mean, I would assume this has a really good chance of passing. Can you imagine, you know, trying to go up against, so let's say you're trying to unseat one of these House members, you know, and they voted against this bill. I mean, you could, it's just, you know, it's made for a, for,
right, it's made for an attack ad. Yeah. I mean, you can just
exactly.
imagine the TV ad, you know, Congressman so-and-so voted against the education perfection bill. You know, I mean, it just.
Right. He wants unsafe college campuses and does, and doesn't want our veterans coming back from Iraq to have college aid. He wants them to be homeless. Yes. So, boy, if we all had the clout of the RIAA and the MPAA, it seems like we'd all be in good shape. Well, one final note in the news roundup. I think that's on a more positive note. If we can end there, Berkeley has, which has always been in the forefront, and I think we actually played their YouTube channel once on the podcast, but they're now, I think, trying to help others get move educational content online, multimedia education in particular. They started an initiative that's been signed on to by a number of universities, actually a few dozen universities, called OpenCast. We'll link to it from digitalcampus.tv on our episode links, but looks like an interesting initiative. I mean, basically they're trying to help out, you know, make the process, and we know this very well, of getting a podcast online is pretty difficult. And I think particularly in a live setting for lectures, Mills, you know this pretty well. It's not that easy, right, Mills?
Right. Well, I mean, it's not that easy if you actually want to edit what you're going to post. I mean, it's actually now pretty simple through iTunes U for me to just record my class and dump it straight into iTunes U. But that's then a really big file. You know, my classes last an hour and 15 minutes, and I don't really want to podcast the entire class. If I were just going to podcast the whole class, it would really be pretty simple. But I end up going back and editing just sort of highlights of the class and posting that instead. And so that's what takes the time. But the interface is not bad. There's a problem, though, with the iTunes U interface at the moment, which is that anybody with administrative access to the account can edit anything in our GMU site. So one of my colleagues accidentally deleted my picture and sent me an email saying, oh, sorry about that. You might want to put it back. So you know, they're still working out some of the kinks on that, but in terms of just recording the class and dumping it straight into the iTunes U account and then having it appear online, that's pretty easy now.
Right. I guess what OpenCast is trying to do is really to provide that full authoring environment.
Right.
You know, where you might have multiple mics, you might have to mix and edit. So, you know, just to streamline the entire process, especially for non-technically savvy people. So, yeah, it'll be interesting to see where this goes. I mean, I think, you know, just in general, I think we're on the cusp of a lot more of this material going online. Mills, you're at the bleeding edge of it. But, you know, it could make for an interesting, you know, I think not only, we were joking about Berkeley using it as a promotional tool, which I absolutely think it is, but I think it's just a sort of public good that professors put stuff online. It's why the three of us have blogs, and podcasts are part of that too.
Yeah, so. And I think this is providing the editing tools is really key, because I think, you know, it's great to put lectures online, but an unedited lecture online, I don't think it suits the medium very well. I don't think it's that interesting to students or anyone. I mean, it's not always that interesting when you're sitting and watching it live and just listening to it on a podcast. And I think a small amount of editing and a small amount of, for instance, like lead-in music and those kinds of things, multiple mics, conversational style, very simple things that you can do that we've tried to do on Digital Campus can make the medium a lot more friendly and will make it a lot more usable and used. So I think any of these tools that are free and easy to use that can allow for really what are kind of simple manipulations, but not maybe not immediately apparent to someone who's new to audio and video production, any of those tools are really welcome.
Well, we're all technophiles on the Digital Campus podcast, and so we love checking out new gadgets and things that come out. And of course, as people who are also into books, we're interested to see the launch of Amazon.com's new ebook reader, the Kindle, which was launched just before Thanksgiving, sold out in 5.5 hours. Which, of course, you never know what that means. They probably had 3 on hand and immediately sold those to the Uber geeks who ordered it. But another attempt at creating some kind of dedicated device for reading books. In this case, actually, the Kindle does newspapers like the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times, some magazines, and blogs as well, which is sort of interesting, taking a medium that really began on a general purpose device, the computer, and taking it onto a dedicated device for reading. And I think all 3 of us probably have pretty strong views on, I think not only on the Kindle, but also just the ebook in general. I mean, this is something that we've seen time and again. Sort of every couple of years a new ebook reader is launched, and none of them have taken off, and it's sort of curious as to why that is. And we thought we'd just discuss, you know, the possibilities of this. For campus, obviously, if you had a device that, you know, you could put our entire library onto and read any book off of it, there's something certainly special about that. But why haven't they taken off? And what are the possibilities of an ebook reader? And what are its drawbacks? So, Mills, you know, what did you? I wrote a blog post about this week, and I can mention that in a second. But maybe we can start with you. What are your thoughts about, you know, the Kindle and then also the ebook more generally? What are its possibilities, and what do you think its negatives are?
Well, I'm like everybody, I guess, from the book generation. On the one hand, I'm kind of excited about the possibility of you know, what an ebook reader would provide in terms of access to lots of books and just that much less that I have to carry around. But I just happen to like the tactile aspect of books, but that's because, you know, I'm 48 years old, and so I grew up with books, and so for me it's hard to let go of that kind of tactile interface. But I do think that, you know, thinking about it rationally, that this is the way that the book publishing market is going to ultimately go, because it is so easy to have access to so much information in an ebook reader form. The question I have, though, is whether the dedicated ebook reader is really going to be the thing that makes the difference, the thing like the Kindle or the Sony's version, or is it going to be just a different computer platform, like a slightly bigger cell phone or a slightly smaller laptop, that ultimately becomes the primary reading platform for people? Right now what they're trying to do is take a book and make it digital, which is kind of like taking a bike and making it fly. You know, books were not intended to be digital. And so it's taking one technology and trying to force it onto another technology.
Right.
And I think maybe they're going about it the wrong way. What I think is really good about the Kindle, I haven't actually held one in my hand, but I've just looked at the videos online, and it seems like the screen is really, really book-like in the sense that it's extremely readable. I mean, for me, this is a real issue just because my vision isn't all that great anymore, and so I have to boost my text size up now to read comfortably, and either that or I have to get new bifocals. And so, it seems like it has the look of a book page, which is, so that's really to the good. But
This is this new e-ink technology that came out of MIT and is not really a screen in that it's a surface where the print actually appears, it is very book-like. If you've seen the Sony Reader, it has the same technology. The Sony Reader's been out now for a year. And it's basically these little balls filled with black dye that spin. And so it has the advantage of looking more book-esque, although to me the contrast, if you've seen the Sony, I haven't seen the Kindle yet, but on the Sony, the contrast isn't exactly book-like. It's still a little bit sort of, you know, dark gray on light gray rather than black on white, but it's better.
So it's certainly more readable.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's definitely more. It looks more readable than my laptop screen, which is pretty readable. So
right.
And it has the advantage of being quite thin and lighter than a paperback, and containing all kinds of information. But I think that there are a couple of big problems with it, other than the fact that it's like trying to make a bike fly. One of them is, it's never going to catch on for the beach, because you can't take it to the beach because it'll get sand in it, and then you've got $400 that you just flushed down the toilet. And the beach is, you know, that or, you know, wherever people like to read, where right. it's dangerous for electronic devices.
Near coffee.
And then the second problem is just that it's just ugly. And, you know, it's when I first saw it, I thought, God, they should have hired a designer from Apple or some place where they do actually good industrial design, because right. there is absolutely right. nothing that's appealing about this. It's just blah. I mean, they could have made it putty colored and it would have been worse, but it's just really blah. And if they're, you know, if what they're trying to do is target the younger generation that doesn't read books nearly as much as we do, this isn't going to work, because they're not going to want just something blah and white looking like that.
Well, I think that's my initial reaction to this is that, I mean, what an amazing marketing job Amazon and Jeff Bezos have done with this thing. I mean, as Dan said, the Sony Reader, which by many accounts is a better reader, has been out for a year. And this thing, it just doesn't strike me as this, wonderfully, game-changing device. E-book readers have been out since at least the late 90s.
Right.
And I just think it's like holiday season desperation among the tech press for something to write about that's comparable to, let's say, the iPhone or last year at this time to the Wii. I just think it's like Amazon did an amazing marketing blitz. The tech press picked it up, and it's good for Newsweek magazine to put it on the cover and say, is this the end of books? So in some respects, I think it's, and maybe this isn't the best thing to say for marketing our own podcast, but this is kind of a non-story in some ways. I think it brings up some interesting questions, though, and maybe that's what will save our podcast and maybe even save the Kindle.
Yeah. Bill's I looked up the designer of Amazon Kindle while you were talking.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So it's Robert Bruner, who was this is rather unbelievable. He's the designer of Apple's original PowerBook. The original PowerBook. Which just goes to show you genius can fail sometimes. Yeah, on my blog I said it looks like many people in our audience may not remember this, but the Sinclair ZX80.
Right, right.
Which was a very early computer that go Google it and you'll see a picture of the ZX80, and I swear it looks uncannily like the Kindle, which is not a good sign when a device in 2007 looks like it's from 1984. My question about this that I posted on the blog, and I think Tom, you were starting to get at this too, is sort of like a more general question. I mean, the design is pretty lousy and the e-ink is pretty good, and we could talk about the technical aspects of this, and actually I think some of the business model aspects of this are pretty interesting. I mean, the books do cost less than a paperback, than a hardback book. They're $9.99 for most books, so it's less expensive, and you can imagine a business model where this would make sense for the publishers, but I still think, why have all these ebooks failed? And I think the problem isn't on the business model or from the publisher's side. It's the fact that, first of all, there's, many generations like, all of us, we like the feel of a book. And, if I'm going to read in a long format, I really like books a lot. And I just think the ebook reader is sort of neither here nor there. And the way I put it on my blog is I compared it to the photo play, which was, if you look back at the history of film, There was this moment in the very early 20th century after the invention of film where everyone thought, oh, well, a film will be a fixed camera on a theater performance. And so it was literally photographing a play, because everyone was used to going to see plays and, okay, here's a film, and what you do is you go ahead and film a play, and that's what film will be. Well, and so people just assume that, okay, a book, well, okay, now we've got the digital medium, and so a book will be some kind of device that looks bookish, and I think it just misses the entire point that we gain something in going online, and we gain something in the general purpose device of either the laptop or, Mills, as you noticed, the cell phone. And I think the iPhone is really the competitor to the Kindle, because I've read stuff on that, and the font is really crisp, and it's easier to hold, and it looks a lot better. You know, if I'm going to read something in a digital format, I want to be able to do stuff to it that I can do to digital stuff. I want to be able to cut and paste from it. I want to be able to put it into folders, relate it to other stuff, link to it for my blog, email it. You know, there's just all these other things that we're used to doing now in a networked computer environment that, you know, okay, so the Kindle has a little keyboard and you can take notes on your books, but, well, how do I get that into Word? How do I aggregate that? How do I use it in Zotero? It's just impossible to think about how this integrates well into the modern research environment. So I don't see the real advantages over a book where, you know, okay, if I'm going to curl up with a book and really, you know, invest time in thinking about the ideas in it, then I'll just use a book and I'll, you know, take notes on my laptop on the side. But I just think, again, this, it's sort of neither here nor there, and it doesn't surprise me that none of these book readers, no matter how good the design, and actually I think if you've seen the Sony Reader, it's quite beautifully designed.
Yeah, it looks great.
But, you know, again, hasn't taken off.
Yeah, I think you're right. It's like a solution in search of a problem. I mean, it really it just isn't there, – there's really in many ways there's nothing wrong with books. There's not a reason – there's no reason to replace them. And I think you're absolutely right that what you get online and on your laptop computer is something different in kind. It's a different experience. It doesn't substitute the book, and it shouldn't substitute the book. It's a different act, and you get something different. You have different expectations going in, and you get something different coming out. So I'm not quite sure this is a huge story.
But I do think there's one possible application of this from a business and educational standpoint that could actually really work. And that is if, for instance, just imagine, for instance, that George Mason gave every student one of these devices, and then the students could just register for their classes and put a little check next to all the books that they wanted to purchase for their classes, and all of those books would be downloaded to their device immediately and their account charged automatically, so they wouldn't have to go stand in line in the bookstore. That would be a number one advantage for them. And second, then, as an instructor, you can instruct your students to all bring their device, whatever it is, to class, and they've got all of their materials, all of their assigned materials. They can't say, they could say, I forgot my Kindle, but they can't say, I forgot, you know, my article that we're going to talk about today. But also, if they can take notes on it, you know, it becomes a point of contact with all of that material. So something like that could be, you know, a model like that, not a device like this, but a model like that could be really exciting for educational purposes. But it's not going to work with this particular device, and the reason is because if the students are going to do that, they're going to want what we've just been talking about, which is a computer where they can check their email and do all of the other things that they want to do while they're using it. So they're not going to want just a book device.
Right. That's
so,
you know,
so
no,
it has yeah. it has really great advantages from a teaching standpoint, but right. It has a basic practical problem of how the students would use it.
Yeah. I hadn't thought about that, Mills, but you know, textbooks would be an interesting case of this. I mean, obviously the price would have to come way down from $400 a pop. But one assumes that $400 is sort of a subsidized price in the same way that in the United States cell phones are subsidized, because they know, well, you're going to have to pay, you know, $60 a month for service. So, you know, they can subsidize the cost quite a bit. The textbook thing is interesting. I remember a test when I was at Yale that they did at the Yale Medical School. They gave all the students a CD-ROM at the beginning of the semester with all of their textbooks on it, or all their readings for their courses. And the problem about it, and so of course they could load it into their laptop, so they do have it on their general purpose device, but the real problem was it was DRM'd, just like the Kindle.
Right.
So
right.
It had, at the end of the year, you lost all these textbooks, which is incredibly frustrating and actually sort of problematic as a med student. If you need to, you know, if you need your anatomy book after the semester's over, shouldn't you have the right to that?
Yeah, was it one liver and two kidneys, or two livers and one kidney? I can't remember.
Right, right. Yeah. Well,
I think the answer to this, I mean, in some respects, in terms of education and kind of a low cost device, would be the one laptop per child machine, where, you know, you're talking about a $200 laptop, which is fully functional, has fully functional word processor, fully functional Wi-Fi and internet browser and everything else. You could almost load all of that stuff onto that device and for half the price give it to students. So there, I think the certainly isn't, I don't think it's going to replace the book, and I don't think it's going to replace the laptop. And the question is there some space in between those two? And I guess we'll see over this holiday season.
It's a great point. Okay, well, we'll leave it there and come back and see how we do after Christmas. Time for Picks of the Week. Let's start with you, Tom.
Oh, all right. I've got something kind of fun. I don't know if you guys noticed, but Marvel Comics just came out with a new archive of all of their, I think all, of their years and years of comics. And they're actually, for a limited time, giving away 250 of them for free. So if you go to marvel.com/digitalcomics, you can find 250 free samples of comics. Most of the free ones are relatively recent comics, but there are, in the larger archive, for an annual subscription of $59, you can get comics dating all the way back to the beginning of the founding of Marvel. So, and they've got a nice reader for them, for cultural historians and people doing history of popular art and things. It could be an interesting resource, and I hope it's something that college libraries pick up on and subscribe to.
Yeah, do they have an institutional subscription for it?
I don't see anything yet on the website, but I'd like to search around a little bit and maybe talk to our library and see if they would get it. For people who are interested in things like history of science fiction and those those kinds of things, things which I'm interested in, this could be a real great resource.
Huh. Wow, I didn't realize that. There must be squeals of delight from nerds all across the planet right now. Okay, Mills, what did you have for this week?
Sorry, I was just squealing. mine is vixy.net. That's VIXY.net. And Vixy is a file converter utility online, where you can take online videos from YouTube or wherever, plug in the URL, and then have Vixy's website converts that file to an AVI or an MOV file or for an MP3 file, audio only, and saves it locally on your computer. So for me, this has been really important because I use a lot of historical video from YouTube, and so now I have those things saved locally on my computer, and so that if they go down from YouTube, I've still got them. But also, where this is going to be really important is for school teachers, many of whom are blocked from accessing YouTube by their school districts. This is something we talked about before. They can now, at their home computers, download the files, the historical video that they want, burn that to a CD, and then take it to school and show the video file that they saved in that way.
So
it's going to be a really great tool.
Sounds great. I think, you know, there are more and more kinds of tools like that for exporting YouTube to kind of other environments. That sounds terrific, particularly for classroom use, and also places where you might not have an internet connection where you'd want to show one of these videos. Terrific. Well, for this week, I'm always interested in historical sites and museums and libraries that are experimenting with new media and ways that they can integrate it into their collections. And I was particularly excited by a link that I saw on the O'Reilly radar that Peter Brantley of the Digital Library Federation noted. And this is phillyhistory.org, so the history of Philadelphia. A lot of great photographs and artworks. And what's really interesting is that they've done a map mashup with this where you can find historical photographs of, for instance, streets. So when I tried it out, I looked at North Broad Street. So this is where City Hall is in Philadelphia. And you can get various views of this from throughout the century. And then you can actually click on a link and see nearby photos, so you can browse it by clustering, and it will actually place them on a map for you, and it's really fascinating. So you can sort of see, you know, if you think about the modern Philadelphia, you can go to a location and then actually see photographs of, and they range all the way back to, I think the earliest one I saw was from 1871. So, you know, it's a really remarkable resource. If you you know, are doing a walking tour or something like that, you can look at what things looked at you know, through the decades. And I think a really nice example. The design is also superb, very clean design. And so I'd encourage people to check it out. It's a little bit hard to find the maps. You just need to go into the search and then click on some of the little icons below each photograph that say you know, see more information, or find others in the recent nearby, and it'll switch you into this map mode. So it's really terrific. I think City of Philadelphia, which sponsors this site, has done a terrific job, and I'd like to see more sites try out things like this. I think it really engages the viewer in a way that your standard archive doesn't. Okay, well, we'll be back in 2 weeks. In the meantime, we'll do lots of reading on our Kindles, right, Tom and Mills?
And
look forward to talking more in a couple weeks on another episode of Digital Campus.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
Please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv, where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
Ask not.